Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 56,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. Politics extends well beyond the ballot box, but elections represent their own site of struggle, a unique opportunity to expose the contradictions between our idealized democracy and its material reality of capitalist exploitation and hierarchical domination. After the self-declared Democratic Socialist's unprecedentedly successful run at the presidency in 2016, Bernie Sanders is back, this time with a vastly more organized working-class movement behind him. Today, we're joined by DSA member Wes Higgins to discuss the emergence of the Democratic Socialist electoral politics in the United States, the state of Bernie's campaign, and how people can get involved. But first, the headlines.
Two NYPD officers who raped 18-year-old Anna Chambers were sentenced to no jail time in a secretive court hearing last week. Eddie Martins and Richard Hall had pleaded guilty to 11 charges and admitted they had sex with Chambers while she was held in their custody. The light sentencing comes on the heels of the acquittal and firing of NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo, who killed Eric Garner in 2014. The family of Eric Garner filed a lawsuit seeking to bring Mayor de Blasio and Police Commissioner O'Neill before a judge to answer questions about their handling of Garner's killing. The family also filed a Freedom of Information request, seeking exhibits and transcripts from the disciplinary trial of Officer Daniel Pantaleo, who was fired last week. The lawsuit relies on a rarely used section of the city charter, allowing any five citizens who pay taxes in New York City to request a formal judicial inquiry into alleged violations or neglect of duty by a public official. A panel appointed by Mayor de Blasio to desegregate New York City public schools has recommended the elimination of all gifted and talented programs in city schools. The recommendations would overhaul the admissions process of the city's public schools and is likely to set off one of the most contentious battles of the de Blasio administration, should he choose to implement them. New York State is encouraging residents to vote on a new design for the state's license plates, but the new license plates will continue to be made by incarcerated people who earn an average of 65 cents per hour. Brooklyn State Senator Zelnor Myrie's bill to raise the prisoner minimum wage to $3 per hour has stalled in committee. However, earlier this week, Governor Cuomo signaled that he supports a raise for incarcerated workers. 3 years after the Department of Correction ostensibly ended solitary confinement for 18 to 21-year-olds, advocates say city jails have implemented a new form of extreme isolation. Known as separation status housing, this rebranded solitary confinement is applied to inmates discovered with contraband items, often regardless of age or other considerations. The city's plan to construct new homeless shelters is lagging behind schedule, leading to a growing reliance on hotels as shelters. One city-funded housing nonprofit was recently found to be housing people in hotel rooms with dangerous wiring hazards, defunct plumbing, and broken furniture. Construction worker injuries and deaths are rising within the city, with immigrant and non-union workers most at risk. A recent report found 92% of construction deaths on private work sites were non-union workers. The latest was a 48-year-old Ecuadorian immigrant who died from a preventable structural collapse last week in the Bronx. Despite the racist and alarmist rhetoric coming from the NYPD police union, It is actually significantly more dangerous to work as a construction laborer in New York City than to work as a police officer. A bill before the state Senate and Assembly seeks to provide economic assistance to taxi medallion owners. The value of taxi medallions crashed in 2014 and has not recovered since, leaving millions of workers in dire situations. The bill would create a loan guarantee program to help medallion holders with debts of up to $175,000 per medallion. Friday was the end of the public comment period for a development seeking to build a warehouse store on the Graniteville wetlands and forests on the western shore of Staten Island. Community organizers are still seeking to prevent the development, which was enabled by a zoning variance approved by Councilmember Deborah Rose in 2017 over objections from the community. The New York City Housing Authority is reportedly driving away women staffers thanks to a toxic work environment cultivated by General Manager Vito Mastasiolo. Recent city council legislation aimed at tracking required reporting from city agencies has revealed an enormous amount of missing reports. The lack of sufficient bike and pedestrian infrastructure on the new $700 million Kosciuszko Bridge has drawn criticism from activist and comptroller Scott Stringer. Housing activists Marcella Mitains and Farah Soufran Forrest are challenging Assembly members Felix Ortiz, District 51, Sunset Park, and Walter Mosley, District 57, Clinton Hill, in next year's Democratic primary. Robert Antonacci, District 50, suburban Syracuse, one of the few Republicans to win a marginal state Senate seat in the 2018 general election, has declined to run for a second Senate term next year. His departure after only 2 years has set off fears within the state Republican Party of a mass exodus now that the party is in a powerless minority.
Our daily headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So, as we mentioned before, today's show is about the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign. And we're joined by someone who is involved in that process. Wes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, before we dive in specifically to, you know, the Bernie campaign, both in 2016, a brief historical overview, and the what's happening right now on the ground, just tell us a little bit about yourself. What, like, forces pushed you into the movement for socialism? Why did you join DSA specifically? And beyond that, like, why is it so critical for socialists to participate in the electoral process?
Okay. So I guess a little backstory would be helpful. So I guess you could say that I was sort of disillusioned for much of my life politically and also just like socially of how I fit into this society, I suppose. You know, in high school, I was more or less almost on the verge of being a dropout. And then I went to community college, almost screwed that up. And then I sort of got into journalism a little bit and became a little bit more focused on politics to see how things worked. I became interested in sort of looking around and was like, I wonder how all these buildings got here. I wonder why the communities we have are the way they are. And so I became very interested in sort of critiquing, taking apart, and examining the social forces that compose everything that's around us. And after, you know, trying to become a journalist to ask those questions by just asking a lot of people, print industry being the way it was, I got laid off. And so what do you do then? You go to grad school. And I had covered local and state politics. I'm like, well, I kind of know a little bit about how it works. I've been to all these meetings. I'll get a degree in political science and master's and NYU accepted me. And then once I actually saw what was under the hood of how the, I guess you could call them political elites, certainly people who work intern in Congress and write these policy papers, you could say like the Heritage Foundation, or even more leftist ones, how they actually think our society works is basically there's no concept of solidarity. They accept a priori that we're atomized individuals who basically have these very selfish preferences. And all politics is basically aggregating those preferences and then finding some median somewhere. And on top of that, our economics works is that we're all pursuing our selfish desires, and we need to figure out ways to best facilitate those, not necessarily to mitigate it, but to just find that golden equilibrium. And then I looked at this and I'm like, this is freaking terrifying. If this is how our society is supposed to run, it sounds extremely lonely and, you know, and violent. A violent abstraction to take these people with wonderful internal lives and external experiences, social experiences, and just violently abstract it from them. And if you don't do that, if you don't play that sort of transactional game with our fellow human beings, then we're going to figure out how to whip you, or as Obama would call it, nudge you to...
perfect euphemism, yeah, coming from Obama.
Yeah, to...
as usual.
To act in this verily atomistic, individualist way. And so I first started critiquing this, what they call neoclassical economics in the political science thing by talking about behavioral economics. Like, no, we're actually not rational calculating beings, are actually highly irrational. And then I realized, well, I'm still sort of looking at it from the individual level, so I'm still kind of going, we're not actually that smart, but I'm not providing any alternatives to it. And so the alternative I found was having a society based on collective solidarity with each other. I guess you could call it finding a general will together and really changing the underlying relations to more social and equitable and just. And there's a lot more you can go in there. But
I think of what you're describing as this really fascinating dialectical process that occurs, yeah, within a specific individual. You had this kind of alienating experience that in high school and community college, where you didn't feel like it was what you were being trained for was geared to your interest, that you didn't actually have too much personal choice. And then when you dove into something, you found a passion, you were then undermined by the broader market forces, that there's something happening in journalism. And then that spurred you to, still kind of go in with the system, take the next step that you're supposed to, you're instructed to from the top.
Right.
Oh, I should go into graduate school, receive more training. That's the one way that I'll be able to save myself individually. But which gave you this insight to the belly of the beast, to how bourgeois ideology,
yeah,
replicates itself and how it naturalizes its hierarchy that it's sitting atop of.
Right. I mean, naturalizing is a perfect example. So and basically the modern day political scientist or economist would look at society and conclude that human beings are inherently selfish. It's sort of like if you were playing, you're watching people play a game and they're all playing Monopoly, and you conclude that all humans hate each other and don't want to play these games together, but they're forced to just get the end of it. When instead of asking, it's like, well, what if they played Candyland instead? Would that maybe be a better system that could bring out better qualities? So, yeah, I would agree with that. To give one example of the bourgeois ideology you're talking about, I remember I was in a PhD class, it was a policy class at NYU, and we were talking about a cost-benefit analysis of justice. So how much is justice worth? And because under the capitalist ideology, everything has to have a value, a exchange value that is related to every other commodity on the marketplace. Justice, therefore, had to be commodified. Forget Nestle commodifying water. Now we're talking about commodifying justice, this very abstract thing. And so the way they did it was they decide, well, what is justice? Since it's a marketplace, supply is going to meet demand, and if you want it so bad, you're going to pay for it. Then, therefore, justice is the median price of a public defender lawyer. They solved it. This is the first question Plato asked in the history of philosophy: what is justice? And these guys solved it. It's just the median price of a lawyer.
It's so wild how this kind of ideology that became so emerged as such a powerful consensus, I would say, in the 80s and the 90s, I mean, in classical economics goes back, but this is like neoclassical, the emergence of like neoliberalism. It kind of accompanies it, in which it really erases history. It erases how capitalism itself, historically contingent development, that market dependency was something that occurred because of the destruction of the means of social reproduction in feudal society, and then kind of the colonialism and slavery that spread and accompanied it. We can't really get into the full details of the origins of capitalism in our short hour here, especially if we want to talk about the Bernie campaign.
Dialectics is the problem of trying to say everything at once, as Frederick Jameson said.
And you read some of Jameson's books, and definitely feels like he's doing that.
I read an introduction to an introduction, and I'm still like thinking about it.
Exactly. So I think what you're getting after there is kind of how this ideology really permeated and became so dominant, and it really almost created like a weakness for the ruling class, that they were incapable of dealing with the crises that they unleashed by kind of pushing out this, I wouldn't say just economic model, this social model in the 80s and 90s through this kind of neoliberal, neoconservative counter-revolution, where in the 2000s, there's crises throughout this process, obviously, but I think you start to see them kind of really emerge in the imperial core with the war on terror and the Iraq war, the sort of disillusionment that creates, as well as the financial crisis, which really kind of exposes the flaw and the fundamental dysfunction of the economic system as it's been reorganized through the neoliberal counter-revolution, where you have so many people lose their wealth. It really spurs this massive concentration of wealth in the very top percentage of the economy. You have this increasing accompanying this. You have this, supposedly this freedom, but at the same time, you have this rise of this mass incarceration, this mass police state and militarization of society. So into this, you start to see more grassroots movements after the 2008 financial crisis. You have Occupy, you have Black Lives Matter, you have the indigenous struggles at somewhere like Standing Rock. And at the same time, then you see like the Bernie 2016 campaign. So how do you see the relationship of these events? How do these events pull people into a movement for democratic socialism? And like, in what ways have they impacted the Sanders platform and campaign? Starting with 2016, then we can move in more to the Sanders campaign now.
Right. Well, I don't want to get like too linearly determined, monocausal. Like 2008 recession was definitely a wake-up call for us all. For me, there was a family trauma going on where my father died, and my family basically had to like fight over what he left. And I lost family that way. And it really showed to me when capitalism fails and there's no alternative to it, then it really becomes like a knife fight, pretty much. So that's what sort of got me starting to think, before it became like hyper refined in this abstract way, what I was just talking about of like, how do we better have more promising social relations? But with 2008, I don't think we can say it necessarily caused people to go out to Occupy, to volunteer for Bernie, but it was definitely some sort of trigger. It didn't force us to do anything. It wasn't like scientific Marxism, but it created the window. So when Occupy happened, they were voicing very salient things. Like it was almost like there's this permeating, I guess you could call it, tension in the air between everyone having a basic decent life and these banks sort of gambling with their own welfare, especially when we're talking about like global south countries with like hot money just swapping it in and out. So how did it all come together? I don't know. What I do want to make clear is that it wasn't Bernie who was like the catalyst for this. Because Bernie's been saying this stuff for decades and decades and decades and decades. So there was definitely some material condition that caused him to catch on when he did. Because otherwise, you know, it's not like no one had heard this stuff before. It just created a window, and these different streams sort of came together in a very multivariate way, very over-determined way, and here we are. Maybe we'll figure out retroactively, you know, what caused what. Maybe it wasn't linear at all. Maybe we need to figure out a different methodology for figuring out how these things come into being. But I'm just riding the wave right now. I'll ask, like, how did it come about later, like, a very clear answer to that.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to make kind of like a clear cause and effect, because you have all these forces interacting at the same time. But I think what you were just like articulating there in terms of that, it wasn't like Bernie was this sort of catalyst for the movement, but that both the crisis and the increase of these social movements, which were about particular forms of violence and exploitation under capitalism that different communities have to deal with, that the combination of these factors has made it created a more receptive audience for this sort of politics.
Yeah.
And that this is the sort of ground that current socialist movement and organizers are operating in and have to take these factors into consideration. But we also have to be clear that Bernie lost in 2016, that there wasn't the...
He could still win, I think.
He could bring it back.
In 2016. He could win. Some way.
We could do some time travel mechanism.
I saw the new Avengers movie, and I think we can go back... spoilers. Deleted scene in the new Avengers movies. We go back, and we fix 2016. Bernie wins. That's it.
So you're expanding beyond the slogan, Bernie would have won, and Bernie will win, but not in 2020, in 2016.
Yeah. Bernie will become a black hole. I'm looking... You're thinking about the socialist horizon. I'm thinking about the socialist event horizon.
We're getting really almost maybe metaphysical in this conversation. I was not expecting to go in this direction, but I find it pretty exciting. But so like, even though he lost, and even though you have a theory that maybe he can go back in time and change that result, like, how have like politics been transformed, like specifically by that campaign, but also just in general by the increasing rise of movements since that campaign? And what have organizers who are engaged in electoral politics learned from that campaign? And like, what are like the most encouraging developments you've seen since 2016? I know that's a pretty loaded and multifaceted question, so take it any direction you like.
I'm going to take it in every direction. So I guess a classic example of the Overton window, which is so overused, is the Medicare for All. Like, Bernie goes up there, he's like, Medicare for All. I can't do a Bernie voice. And then like 4 years later, everyone's about Medicare for All, except now it's like an empty signifier and Kamala Harris can have a Medicare for All or whatever. But point is, like, yeah, he pushed some big, bold issues. It spoke to people, and then it caught on, and he pushed the Democratic Party to the left. I don't really buy the whole left-right spectrum thing. I think it's much more complicated than that. But that's like your classic Overton window example. But I think what's more important to me is not this sliding to the left, but more like expanding and drawing in the political universe and orbit. So for the longest time, I think people in this country's idea of what politics was, what democracy was, is you go to the ballot booth every 4 years, and if you're super, you know, political, you go every 2 years and you press a button. It's very like consumer choice theory of what is politics, what is the demos. And I think with Bernie Sanders, with his slogan, not me, us, is he's hopefully starting people to start to realize that politics should expand beyond that consumer choice. In fact, not even expand, maybe even in like a whole new paradigm. So, you know, that looks like making democracy or the workplace a democracy with unions, with fighting over higher wages, but also more control over the workplace. And just thinking, how can we bring what before was a series of choices between private, atomized individuals in the civil sphere and making it more, elevating it to like a public sphere where politics can, you know, be a part of life, a process of our daily lives.
Yeah, I think like something that I have seen, or I guess this is more heard, which I think is a very fascinating development, was take one of these most recent debates. Bernie's closing statement was, everyone up here has these plans. Some of them are great. And you've heard these great plans all throughout your life. But why haven't they been implemented? Yeah. And then Bernie goes to articulate a theory that there are class enemies, there are class interests that do not want these policies to happen, and that these class interests, the ruling class, the capitalists, Bernie normally specifies specific industries, doesn't really use like more classic like Marxian rhetoric like bourgeoisie, but he'll say the fossil fuel industry and pharmaceutical companies. That would be the sort of framework that he'll set this conversation in. And I think that is like what you're kind of highlighting, is that changing politics, and then he specifies the only way to overcome these factors is not just to elect someone, but build a movement. And I think what that movement is a serious debate within social circles and how to build that power.
Yeah.
But I think we can see even kind of this emergence of this recent strike wave and other forms of organizing, like confronting ICE, have kind of even enabled Bernie to further push his rhetoric of class warfare. Is that something that you feel like you're seeing as well?
Sure. I mean, going back to on the points you made a few seconds ago, I think that ultimately is what distinguishes Bernie from something like a Warren candidacy, is that he realizes that no matter how smart he is, and I think Warren's probably smarter than him, to be honest, no matter how moral he is, he gets in there and he's not going to be able to get stuff done, you know, just by himself. I'm not even talking about like a locked up judiciary full of Republican ghouls. I'm not even talking about like the filibuster rule or whatever and all these procedural things in the Senate or House. I'm talking about the limits that the state has under capitalism. It's bound. Like, the state can only do so much until people start pulling out their money, stop buying bonds. S&P or Moody's comes and says, we're going to junk your rating. You know, that happened in New York City, you know, decades and decades ago when they tried to do some real progressive stuff, and they come and they say, hey, we're going to take the money away. It's going to be junk unless you do what, you know, the rich people want to make sure that they get a return on their investments. I mean, the tax money is coming from the rich, which of course is coming from the workers, but nonetheless, they do control that capital. So I think Bernie understands that. He understands the limits that he'll be operating under, and he'll know. So like Elizabeth Warren, even though she's no longer Republican, I think she's still operating under the equilibrium sort of paradigm where it's out of balance right now between like capital and labor, for instance, but there's some golden equilibrium she can find where everyone will be happy, where that marginal utility value or whatever you want to call it is working great. Everyone's getting their fair share. The capitalists are getting the right rate of return for their capital that they input into the equation. The labor's getting the right amount of wages for their labor. It's all happy. The landlords are doing great. Everyone's doing fine. If she gets in there and she can't do that because of there actually being inherent contradiction to capitalism and not just external, then I don't think she's going to be willing to cause trouble. I think she'll just keep pulling her hair and going, oh, there's got to be another way to put this, you know, machine back together. Versus Bernie is like, yeah, this machine is terrible. This is a junker. Let's put it on the side of the road and get like a, you know, public trans. I don't want to say a nice new car, but like a nice bullet subway that's ecologically friendly instead.
A nice new train. Yeah, I think it's what you're articulating, and I think it's pretty clear from the rhetoric they use and even the policies they espouse, is that Warren is, at the end of the day, a left liberal technocrat, that she has inclinations for a fair society, but she believes that capitalism can produce us in the right technocratic fixes, the right fixes from the state can produce this equilibrium. Well, the theory that Bernie is operating on is that there's inherently these class antagonisms, and that the state favors the interest of the wealthy because that is the way the system is designed. And the only way to confront that is to shift the balance of forces of power, to give space through, I guess, through his particular position, to give space as the leader of the state for forms of working class organization to develop so they can confront the concentrated capital, the ruling class. And I think I would love to continue this theoretical, not theoretical conversation, but the distinctions between the two candidates. But also, I think this argument of Bernie's is the primary reason why an organization like DSA has endorsed him and is involved in the campaign. And what I want to transition to just in a moment is DSA's involvement in the campaign, how they got involved, why they're involved, and what sort of work that DSA is doing. But first, I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com or sign up for our newsletter to get links to what we talk about on the show. You can do that at our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com. And you can also find us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about Bernie Sanders' 2020 electoral campaign for the presidency and the Democratic Socialists of America's involvement in that campaign. So just briefly, and we don't have to get into all the intricate details and of the process, but how did DSA decide to get involved with Bernie 2020, and like, why is democratic decision making so crucial for a socialist organization, and like, to make it not just a fair process but an effective one long term?
To give a overview, it happened on multiple levels. So there's New York City DSA, and then there's, you know, national DSA. New York City DSA, the citywide, they passed a detailed proposal last January on what our field campaign would look like for Bernie. And Bernie, before I go any further, because our lawyer might, you know, choke me or kill me afterwards, we're operating as a independent expenditure campaign, which means we're not coordinating with the Bernie campaign. Therefore, we don't have a formal role in the campaign. Yes, I am reading this. Instead, we're creating a full-scale field operation of our own, which is using multiple tactics, voter reg, street canvassing, door canvassing, campus tabling, etc. This has allowed us to get in the field really early this summer versus a couple of months before the New York primary. It allows us to train, develop, and broaden our volunteer base long before most campaigning starts in New York. It also allows us to design and test our specifically socialist messaging and materials. So that was like my prepared statement.
You did a great job.
Thank you. Someone else wrote it for me. But going back, yeah, so basically we knew National DSA really probably wanted to do Bernie work. They did a poll of the membership, and a good majority, I forget the exact numbers, said they should endorse Bernie. New York City DSA, because we're such good go-getters, we thought we should prepare for that. So before National DSA gave an endorsement, we gave like sort of like a you could call it like a quasi-endorsement, and it was a blueprint for campaign strategy, leadership structure, division of labor, and basically so we could rapidly launch the New York City DSA campaign as soon as we got the go-ahead. So that was a very long process. Going to your questions, the democratic planning, you know, it went through a lot of amendments. I wasn't actually there at that point involved in that process, but I do remember hearing about how many amendments and back and forth there was. So it was very open. There was a lot of citywide representatives from the different DSA branches, like in Brooklyn, like in Queens, who were bringing it to the membership to discuss it, to bring back feedback. And eventually, after this long formal process, we got the blueprints and the go ahead, and then we pretty much started, I want to say, back in June, in terms of actually having people like me in the field.
Got it. So I forgot that we didn't mention this early on, but yeah. What are your specific roles in the campaign, and then what is, and then just like elaborate further than that, like what is the sort of work that DSA members are doing? I know you just kind of briefly went through that in the statement, but yeah. Maybe in a more
concrete,
yeah, more concrete, yeah, manner, and also without the legal language. Obviously, don't do anything that's creates, yeah, any problems. But
yeah, yeah.
In terms of like, what's the actual work that's going,
okay,
on?
Okay, cool. All right, well, awesome. That's where my strong suit is, because I didn't really understand what I was reading out loud either. So basically, what it looks like is we go to the park. And we sweat a lot, and we have clipboards, and we talk to people about socialism and Democratic Socialists of America and Bernie Sanders, and turns out their public is pretty stoked about it. Yeah. So that's really good news. Like, when it started, I guess you could say, like, if you look at like the very abstract stuff I was talking about before, you know, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. Well, it started out, you know, I think more of under the theory that DSA was going to build capacity. You heard this a lot, like, Bernie's how we're going to build membership. So basically, it seemed like DSA was going to ride on, like, Bernie's coattails. And so we sort of, like, thought, like, oh, yeah, so if Bernie wins, then we win. If Bernie wins, more people will come to us. And so we should really focus, you know, on a more traditional, like, register people to vote, because if you look at, like, some regression somewhere, the most significant variable about whether someone voted for Bernie in 2016 was whether they were a first-time voter, and that's controlling for age. So no matter the age or any other variable, it made it more likely. So we put a heavy focus on voter registration. So basically we go out there and we go, hey, are you registered to vote? And then if they said yes, or we'd be like, do you like Bernie? But if they said no, and then we try to have like more deeper conversation about them, about the issues, stuff like Medicare for All, Green New Deal, and then Bernie, and then DSA. But we realized pretty quickly that leading with that more traditional style of just asking if they're registered to vote didn't really work that well. So we sort of put it on his head, and we're like, okay, we need to be more confident in ourselves that the stuff that we care about, people might care about too. So we, as of more recently, like a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, we pretty much are out there in the parks going, hey, would you like to help us support getting Medicare for All? And a lot of people stop for that. Or would you like to help us support getting Green New Deal? And a lot of people stop. And we really put, instead of like our success, DSA success coming in like through the back door of like Bernie winning, we're just going straight through the front door with DSA and issues. So yeah, we talk about Green New Deal or Medicare for All for a little bit. We get them to sign like a petition saying like they do support stuff like this and that they do support Bernie. And while they're sort of signing, we start talking about all the great stuff DSA has done, such as the Housing Justice Campaign, such as Julius Salazar, Gabon, the Public Power Green Deal, Public Power Campaign with the Eco-Socialist. And then we're sort of suss out like how easily politically activated these people might be. And if someone is like, I've already heard of DSA, you know, I've been wanting to get involved in politics so long, but I don't know what to do except, you know, vote. Then, you know, we're like, okay, it's worth meeting this person one-on-one. and we'll sit down with them and we'll go, hey, I know it's really confusing. Like 2 years ago, we sort of all came together in a room after Trump won. Is like, what the hell do we do now?
Checking the word list.
Yeah. And so I get it, man. And then we'll try to help them out, figure out what's interested in them, interest them. If they're, you know, not as active, but it seems like there's a chance, then we'll phone bank them. We're North Brooklyn is holding a town hall in October, late October, no set date yet, and we're sort of canvassing around that in the Bushwick area. And at the town hall, I mean, I can't tell you everything that's going to be in it because it really isn't just about what I want. You know, we get a lot of help from like political education, for instance, from different working groups about the different issues. The first one will be more general, just sort of like a general overview of socialist politics. And then if we do ones after that, it'll be more focused, like one on America for All, one for Green New Deal, one for housing, of course, like paying attention to interrelations to all these issues. So the basic idea, I guess, is just extending DSA's orbit. So it's not just like self-selected activists in a room and trying to draw the people in one step from where they are right now into our organization.
So like as opposed to making it all about this one person, that Bernie is going to come save us, that we need him and that's the core aspect of the campaign. Yep. It's really about making it – these are the issues – that are confronting you. This is your material reality. These are the sort of institutions, the bourgeois institutions, the forces of the state that are putting you down, that are making your life tough, that are creating violence against you. And these are the sort of solutions that can challenge their power. And yeah. Not even just those are the solutions. And here's the sort of movement, the sort of organization that can bring these different arenas of struggle together, that can build a force that can unify and challenge the ruling class.
Yeah, that sounds good. Do you want to speak at the town hall?
I'd be open to it if they'd follow up with me.
Yeah, exactly. And it, I don't want to be like too paternalistic. Like, I think a good canvasser is someone who listens more than they speak. And I always say that, and I always end up speaking more than I listen. But, I mean, it's really easy to sort of help people connect the dots of why their life might seem kind of alienated. And really, once you sort of describe to them how politics could be so much more and how there could be that sense of solidarity, and here's a good step in that direction with Democratic Socialist America, then bada bing, bada boom, you know, you're on a first step together. And I would also say it's not about changing people's minds in the field. Like me, myself, I was disillusioned not too long ago. You really do change when you're doing this stuff. I didn't know what solidarity meant. I might have been able to find it in the dictionary like a year ago, but it wasn't really until being with DSA for a while that it started truly mean what solidarity meant. And it's something a little bit ineffable.
Yeah, it's like a process that emerges through mm-hmm. collective action. You have to build that bond. That it's just not like, I think like what you were talking about before when you're just like, oh, the crisis didn't just cause these – like it wasn't solely the crisis. Like bad things happen all the time. You actually need to build to work and build up that solidarity, build up the organizational capacity to actually enact what you're fighting for. That you can't just like see things abstractly.
It has to be the dialectic between concrete and abstract. And what is abstraction is just vagueness without that concreteness. I would say you asked earlier about like how is the Bernie work democratic. I can answer you how it is concretely democratic. So when I run these North Brooklyn for Bernie organizing meetings, we had just had one a couple of weeks ago. It's not just me going up there and being like, hey, here's our work. Here's what we're going to do. Like, for instance, the town hall I just mentioned wasn't my idea. I know Bernie did barn burners or whatever in 2016, which were pretty successful, although he didn't do it. It's, you know, grassroots activists who just did it themselves, it seemed like. But I go in there and I'm sort of like, hey, I'm just a human person. I don't have all the answers and organizing's really hard. Please help me. And so we all come together and I don't. So I've been asking myself a question about democracy lately and this sort of like I don't want to call it dichotomy, but this relationship between content and form. So a lot of people get obsessed about what is the form of democracy, and since like voting procedures or formal mechanisms to ensure a democratic process, and that stuff is important. Like, you know, ranked choice voting is extremely important. But we really need to start thinking more about what is the content of democracy. What is democracy, this public decision-making process that allows individuals to transcend themselves into this collective sort of super emergence? What does that content look like? So it's not making sure everyone gets a vote. It's making sure that people are acting in this sort of collective mode together. So in these organizing meetings, it's all about us just coming together, having a conversation that's deliberative, that gets us to figure this stuff out together.
Yeah, like how people are engaged in the collective process. And I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com or sign up for a newsletter to get links to what we talk about on the show. You can do that on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, and you can also find us on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign and the DSA's relationship to the movement for democratic socialism in the electoral sphere and beyond. But now we want to open up our phone lines. We have about 10 minutes left in the show, so we want to hear from you. Like, please give us a call at 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. You can call in, give us your thoughts on the Bernie campaign. If you want to ask Wes how to get involved, please feel free to do that. If you just want to give your thoughts in the general state of the capitalist horror show that we're living under, we're happy to hear that too. So just please call in 212-209-2877. So as we wait to hear from our listeners, if they're so inclined, you've been talking about what you've been hearing when you're engaging with voters, and like, what are their like biggest concerns, and how are we using these interactions to build like working class institutional power? Like, something that I've been thinking about is if you're knocking on doors in a sitting housing complex, mm-hmm. and people are constantly talking about an issue that they have with their landlord, like, how are we taking that information and using it to possibly build up like a tenants organization, which is like an organization that we're talking about, like collective action, which is like democracy rooted in people's housing and fighting for that, just like fighting for a union in a workplace. And if that's too specific a direction, so, take it somewhere else.
I get it. I'm the field coordinator, co-coordinator of Brooklyn Electoral. And so I'm all about field. And, you know, don't get me wrong, like Caban almost won, Salazar won, and AOC won on field. Like 117,000 doors, knocking doors, get out the vote, 3 days for Caban. That's astounding. And that's how we won. But, you know, it's kind of limited. You can't go to every single door. And because these people are so atomized, you have to have those single conversations with each one. And that's going to be really hard to do if we're talking about taking over the whole government. So we do need to start thinking about how building those collective institutions. That could be something like tenants units. That could be plugging into existing community groups and building coalitions that way, such as we saw with the Housing Justice Alliance. Unions. Unions, again, it's not just because it's great to have that reliable union vote, but because they have a structural position in the capitalist economy that could actually disrupt it and make something of those contradictions to use them as an opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And that sort of power dynamic is essential to explore if you have this sort of theoretical understanding of how politics actually operates. So we've got a caller. You are live on Revolutions Per Minute. What's your name? What's your question or comment?
Hi, my name's Max. I've been around PSA for about a year and a half, and very disappointed, I have to say. I'm 58-year-old working man, and I'm a socialist from a socialist background, but loosely affiliated various Trotsky groups. and Unionsville the last 40 years, but I'd like to say in that context that I'm very disappointed, actually, in supporting Democratic candidates. The TSA is doing, there's a great potential for revolutionary expansion, and it's being wasted with this naive almost support for the Democratic candidates. We're not going to save us, and I hope you all remember my name, whether after the next election, and come to me and still be my comrade when we are inevitably either disappointed or betrayed by Bernie Sanders, or we get another fascist or right-wing Republican or right-wing, standard Democrat. And with that being said, I'd also like to register my criticism of some of the organizers who have been extremely dysfunctional toward me in the Queens branch. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, Max, but do you want to address this at all?
So there is a newly released, not released, wrong word, median, mediator process. So if Max does have complaints about the Queens branch, I would suggest he reaches out to mediator. In terms of his first more substantial point, I don't exactly disagree. I'm not putting all my hopes on Bernie. It's not about him. I just see elections as a form of class struggle, but only a form. And so he's right. Yeah, elections aren't going to save us all. But sorry, the truth is that most Americans, unfortunately, only relate to politics via elections, especially presidential elections. So we got to start there and figure out how to use that to expand from there. I guess that's it.
Yeah, I understand the skepticism towards electoral politics, and I think anyone participating in that who has a socialist analysis has to understand the sort of contradictions that you're dealing with. But we have to also recognize, or people engaging in, at least in trying to build the socialist movement, that there is a lot of people gravitating towards this. So how do we respond to that? And that is an important question. And how does power get built in relation to that is a key question. And I don't think people have all the answers, but I think it's important to engage with it. And we have another caller. You are live on Revolutions Per Minute. What's your name and what's your question?
Yes, my name is Dave, and I want to make a comment regarding the amount of people on rent stabilized or rent controls, a little over a million in New York City. Yet, you know, when I used to volunteer for Met Council on Housing and take phone calls, I was surprised to learn that, you know, the membership is so low. It's about 2,800 or 2,800, like 10 years ago. How is that possible? The realization is that people are competing against each other. No one really wants to put their, you know, wants to get together. This is a very adversarial, confrontational, highly competitive society where there are very few good jobs. There are very few. It's very difficult to get into a great school, whether it be the kindergarten or college or you name it. So, you know, the enemy is us. The unions, many of them are building these luxury towers in Manhattan. The unions are doormen, they're concierge. You know, people are paying, you know, $3 for a simple cup of coffee because people are willing to pay for it. People, you know what I'm saying? People are willing to buy condoms that cost $1 million and something. So the people are the problem. People, I mean, think about it. There are a million rent-stabilized and rent-controlled apartments, yet, you know, ask how many members there are in the Met Council or any other housing. Nobody's interested. Everyone's looking out for themselves.
I think what you're doing here is you're in a sense erasing some of the forces that propel people to act in this way. If it's hard to join a council or get participated in an organized process, if all the social functions of your life gear you towards competing with others, when resources are dwindling,
we're talking about paying a membership. We're talking about just paying, signing a check. I used to take phone calls from people who wanted to game the system and live somewhere else and keep the rent stabilized apartment. And how many days do I have to have, and how many receipts do I have to have? You know, there should be a membership. There used to be a strong rent movement in the late 70s and early 80s. And then I don't know what happened to it. Everyone's fragmented. Everybody, you know, I voted for Caban, you know, and I know a lot of people who voted for Caban. And I, you know, there were enough to kind of almost get her over the hump. But my question to you is, where are those million people? Where are the 500? You know, why are these people? If there's a million people, 1,200,000 rent control, rent stabilized. How come there's so few people involved in the movement? I don't get it.
I think it's a real challenge. I think it's not easy to build working class organization. There are forces allied against developing that. And I would love to articulate and explore this conversation a little bit more, and it's something that we try to do on this show, but we are coming to a close. Just before we wrap up, is there any events that you would like to highlight to our listeners in the coming days if they want to get involved in the Bernie campaign?
Yes, there is. So the way the Bernie work is structured is it's split up between regions: Queens, Lower Manhattan, Upper Manhattan, Bronx, and then North Brooklyn, Central Brooklyn, South Brooklyn. But luckily, we do have a map for you where you can see all the stuff going on with Bernie DSA, which again is an independent expenditure campaign. You go to bernie.dsausa.org. bernie.dsausa.org, and then you go to the button that says find an event, and then a map of all of America will pop up, except for Hawaii, I guess it looks like, and Alaska. But you'll see New York, and you'll zoom into New York City, and then all across Brooklyn and Queens and Manhattan, you will see events. Click on them. North Brooklyn is doing them pretty much every other week. Central Brooklyn, about the same thing.
All right, great. Thank you so much for joining us, Wes. I feel like we had a really great conversation, and I'm really looking forward to how the Bernie campaign develops over the next year and a half, and how the movement continues to grow. So thank you so much for joining us.
There's still a year and a half left.
And thank you to our listeners for checking in. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.